Hello, and welcome to episode 66 of the Sci-Fi Podcast from Bloomington, Indiana. I'm Nick Zoutra. On today's podcast, I am pleased to welcome Dr. Caterina Marchioni, University Lecturer in Practical Philosophy and member of TINT, Center for Philosophy of the Social Sciences at the University of Helsinki. Caterina's research interests are in philosophy of science, philosophy and methodology of economics, and philosophy of the social sciences. She works mainly on scientific models, explanation, interdisciplinarity, and evidence. Caterina is the associate editor of the Journal of Economic Methodology, and since January 2018, serves as the chair of the International Network for Economic Method. And thus, without further ado, let's bring in Caterina. Dr. Caterina Marchioni, welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this afternoon?
Thank you. Thank you, Nick. I'm good. It's a great day. It's just my first hour of work, and then celebrations are starting. Tomorrow is holiday. The term is finished. And so it's a great day.
Fantastic. So, as we were just chatting a little bit before we started the recording, so you just finished up lecturing for a class. Which class was this?
It was Philosophy of Social Science Advanced.
Oh, okay.
So it's a master course. It's basically a reading seminar with students presenting like a paper each week. Mm-hmm. It goes through two terms. So here terms are like 3 months terms. So we have 4 terms in a year. And this goes through 2 terms. And then students come and present the paper, and then there is general discussion. I'm basically mostly coordinating discussion. Sure. It was a great course, actually. I had great students. I enjoyed it a lot, and I learned a lot, and it was very lots of fun. It's one of my favorite courses, I have to say. It's really a lot of fun to do that. So although I'm happy that it's finished, I'm going to miss the students and our weekly discussions and the challenges, because, of course, it's easier, like, it doesn't require so much preparation as if I had to lecture for an hour and a half, right?
Right.
But still, you need to improvise a lot.
Yeah.
Because you never know where the discussion is going, and if you have bright students are really coming up with good connections and objections and seeing like or connecting with other parts of philosophy or something like that. So yeah. There is always, it's a bit stressful in the sense that sometimes I'm like, okay, well, guys, I don't have the right ammunitions for this. So I'll upload something later on. But it also gives a good, it also is an occasion for me to learn quite a bit, I think,
So when you say philosophy of social science, what are some of the topics or questions that the students and you are discussing and addressing?
The classic topics would be values and science. So at least a few decades ago, philosophy of social science was basically defined by the questions, are the social sciences inferior or different from the natural sciences, right?
Yeah.
So you would ask questions such as, is the impact of non-epistemic values a more serious threat in social science than in the natural science? Or you would ask, is explanation in social science, has explanation in social science the same form as explanation in the natural science? So does it require, mm-hmm. understanding social phenomena requires different methods, methodologies? So, for instance, there have been arguments to the fact that, in fact, in social science, we don't explain with causes, but we try to understand people's behavior, and understanding it's a different methodology. It's something about, for instance, putting yourself in the shoes of the agent and trying to understand his actions rather than finding the causes of phenomena.
So is this more in the terms of like things like sociology, anthropology? What social science?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's economics, sociology, anthropology, history to some extent.
Right.
Social psychology, if you will.
Some kind of psychology. Yeah, because there's a blend of, for example, from the discipline of psychology where I come from, you have sometimes a very, almost like a natural hard behavioral science that is not so much meaning finding, or at least doesn't intend to be. But right. But then some kinds of psychology, course. Very much narrative, you know, drawing on narrative structures and other kinds of ways of interpreting and understanding things. Cultural psychology, it's very much in the social realm.
Exactly. So, but also, for instance, this idea about understanding, like the Verstehen, like that social science is in the business of understanding, is not so much. Is not being so popular in like fields like economics or political science. It's been quite popular though in anthropology, for example, because it's really like about anthropologists going into different cultures and try to understand why do people behave the way they do, and is it like something that we can use the same methods that the social science as the natural sciences, or we need something else, and we need like, for instance, to immerse ourselves in the culture and try to put ourselves in the shoes of these other cultures and trying to understand why they do what they do, they believe what they believe. So these are some of the questions, but then there are also things about how to use models, experiments, what kind of features experiments and models have in social sciences, some other peculiarities of social science or alleged peculiarities like... Mm. Reactivity, the fact that people might react to the fact of being studied, the looping effect, you know, the hacking idea.
Right, about the looping effect.
These kinds of things, so other peculiarities that we can... So that's the structure of... So that's some of it. And then the nature of social reality, right? Social ontology, for example, that's also part of a philosophy of social science course. So what are the building blocks mm-hmm. of social reality?
For those of us, the listeners, that you're a lecturer in practical philosophy at the Center for Philosophy of Social Science. So this is, is this an area where other lecturers, other folks who are working there are particularly their research and or teaching is specifically in philosophy of social science?
Well, in fact, the discipline is called practical philosophy, and it's a standard practical philosophy department, let's call here. It's not a department, but we shouldn't go into the administrative structure of this university because it's quite complicated.
So by practical philosophy, is applied philosophy?
It's ethics. Political philosophy and philosophy of social science, basically.
Cool. Okay.
And then we have, in the university, we also have theoretical philosophy, which belongs to a different, actually, faculty, which is history of philosophy, logic, and so on and so forth, and also philosophy of science. But anyway, that's also an interesting story that you might bump into if you did some history of the Finnish philosophy. But anyway, so I am at the moment a lecturer in practical philosophy, and I am the lecturer in philosophy of social science. So okay. My description is lecturer in philosophy of social science. And then there is this research group, let's call it, a center of philosophy of social science that gathers together several researchers. Some might be lecturers, some might be of something else, or they might be having grants or these kinds of things, or they are in different departments even. Mm-hmm. So some people are in theoretical philosophy, some people are in... political science and so on and so forth, and then so it gathers together this,
Okay.
But and it comes from, so until a few years ago, a couple of years ago, we were even bigger. We had a big fund, common funding from the National Science Foundation of Finland, which is called Academy of Finland.
Okay.
And now we are a bit smaller, but we're still here and doing good.
I've taken a look through just the people. Comprehensive and expansive research group, it seems.
Yeah. So we could attract lots of people when we had this very significant
big grant.
Big grant. And some people managed to stay. They found individual grants. We still have some common grants, but nothing like the big umbrella that we had. It was called a Center of Excellence.
Yeah.
So it was a Center of Excellence funding instrument. And that allowed us to attract lots of people. It's quite fun. It's quite also unlike unlike us, some other Finnish institutions in which because we have quite a few foreigners as well. Finland is not big. Departments are quite small, so you might have one or two foreigners at most.
Well, let's I'm really curious to find a little bit more about the Center for Philosophy of Science, your current work there, your future work there, everything and anything around there. But before we do that, why don't we take a step back and trace a little bit of your story of how you got into philosophy of social science to begin with. So, Katarina, if you wouldn't mind, tell us a little bit about where you grew up, what were things like, how this all got started.
Yeah, so basically, in fact, before being a philosopher of social science, I was a philosopher of economics. I am a philosopher of economics. I'm still a philosopher of economics.
Yeah.
And before that, I was, an economist. In a sense, so I grew up in Padova, which is a city in the northeast of Italy.
Yeah.
It's quite close to Venice.
We'll learn about that in the history of science course, history of medicine, I should say.
Because that is the oldest anatomical theater.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's the oldest anatomical theater in shape with the. Yeah, the
amphitheater.
The filter shape so that everybody could look at the doctor dissecting the corpse.
Mm-hmm.
If you have occasion, it's quite nice to go see it. Anyway, I grew up there and I did my studies there. So I did my both undergraduate and master studies there, but not in philosophy. I did it in political science.
Okay.
Branch political economy.
Mm-hmm.
So when I graduated was with a thesis. My master thesis was kind of between a theoretical and empirical work on the effect of migration on the housing prices in Milan.
Oh, okay. Well,
right.
Tell us a little bit about that. The short story of how you got, how you came to be working. Well, I mean, even before that. So how did you, were you interested in before that? So like you became a political scientist, but like but even before that, growing up younger, teenage, whatever, like what were your interests? What were you thinking back then? What was kind of... Yeah.
Okay, so I have to say that unlike some other people, I wasn't always who then become academic. I wasn't always a very good student. First few years of high school, I was really I had totally different interests that had nothing to do with academia. But in any case, I always liked, I guess, that my favorite subject. And it was just in the first few years that I started to get a taste for it. And I particularly enjoyed philosophy. So in Italy, we have in certain high schools, you do 4 years of philosophy. It's mostly history of philosophy, but it's philosophy and history. And I was very lucky that the same teacher was teaching history and philosophy, and even history, he taught it in a way that was quite engaging because it was also lots of historiography, so a meta perspective on history. And I guess that's already, I think that those were the some of the subjects I like more, and I guess that reflects on what happened later, that I enjoy to look at, to take this meta perspective, right, and like in on science or on the humanities in that particular case. But then after I finished high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do, right? I mean, I was like, okay, maybe I want to do sociology, maybe I want to do history, maybe I want to do this.
Sure.
And I was really undecided. And then one of the good things about political science is that the first year of political science back then, you would take courses that were common across very different bachelor. For example, you would take sociology, you would take history, you would take political economy, macroeconomics, actually, and so on and so forth. Political science. So then I thought, okay, I'll sit for a year in political science and see, and then maybe in this year I decide what I really want to do. Mm-hmm. And then for reasons that I don't think I've been able to rationalize, even exposed why I decided to go political economy, to remain political science and to study the economics branch. So I have no idea. Maybe, I guess it was because that would give me more chances to find a job. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't thinking about academic career. So I thought that's going to give me more chances to find a job afterwards.
Sure.
And then I did, and then I found this teacher. She was, she's called Francesca Gambarotto. She is such a great teacher, and she got me really hooked up in, urban economics. And that's how I did my master's. And then she was, she's an economist, urban economist, but she's a bit critical, let's say, of the mainstream economics. Mm-hmm. And so she was pushing me to read much more widely than the standard economics. So I was reading Amartya Sen, I was reading Schelling, I was reading some stuff in urban planning, in geography, which are not usually things that urban economists would do, or not the standard ones, at least. And then at some point after I finished my thesis, like a few weeks later, this teacher calls me up and she says, look, there is this fellowship for studying abroad.
Mm.
Do you want to apply? And I was like, but their deadline is like in a week. And I was like, I don't even know where I want to go. I mean, I've never thought about it. I was like, oh, there is this nice programs in philosophy and economics in Rotterdam. Try there. Apply for there.
Sure.
I got the fellowship. I got into the nice programs in economics and philosophy in Rotterdam. And then that's how I ended up doing philosophy. Basically like this. There was no... And then when I was there, I really thought, okay, this is what I want to do.
Yep.
I really like this. And then I moved away from the economics, like, yeah. And started to do philosophy. So my PhD thesis then was philosophy of economics.
Okay. Well, yeah. all right. Well, tell us. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your training in philosophy and philosophy of science? So, like, how did you come about coming? So it sounds like, you know, we come to find interest, but then there's a translation of, or there's a, you know, there's a time when we come to like really start to understand like the moves that philosophers make, the kinds of stuff that we want to do or we find that is worthwhile. So if you could tell us a little bit about your experience with that and perhaps either influential folks or your trials of trying to do work and, you know, seeing it, you know, doing. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that.
So, well, the good thing was that the first year at this, so it's called APE, it's called Erasmus Institute for Philosophy and Economics. It's one of a it's a well known institute which focuses on philosophy of economics. It still exists and still produces quite a few PhDs. And the good thing about that was that the first year was a MPhil. Mm-hmm. So basically, as thrown there And then there was, I had to take all these many courses and just write philosophy essays, basically. Well, a few were something in economics, but mostly were the courses were philosophy courses, philosophy of economics, let's say, or philosophy of science. And so basically, and then I remember, I think we had to write about one essay every 2 weeks or something like that. It was quite intense. And that's where I got my first training. And that's how I learned the trade, how to write, for example, an essay in philosophy, which is quite different from how you write it in other discipline, for example. Mm-hmm. And that was very useful. I had great teachers there, so who philosophy, like, quite well-known philosophers of economics like Huskelly Mackey and Jacques Roman and Wade Hands and John Davis. They were all my teachers when I was there. So I really learned the trade. But of course, and yeah, and then in later years, I also tried to keep up with the filling in the gaps in my philosophical education, let's say, mm-hmm. a bit by self-study, but also, you know, the first couple of years at least, or at least the first year of PhD, after I finished the master and I was doing the PhD, I followed quite a few courses in, also given by other philosophers at the other philosophy courses at the philosophy department in Erasmus University, and then a bit of self-study, of course. So that's how. So it was a bit of a challenge, I have to say. And for many years, it's something that I felt that was kind of feeding my imposter syndrome, right? I was like, yeah. Okay, yeah. But I guess I can say now I feel okay. Now I feel that I know what I'm supposed to know. I mean, of course, there is much more I can know.
Right.
I can, but I don't feel anymore like I should have, that it would have made so much of a difference if my bachelor was in philosophy. That's what I mean.
You think so? Yeah, I mean, I can relate that my bachelor's wasn't in philosophy. Really only began really studying philosophy during doing like a master's, but it was... yeah, you start with like there's so much background knowledge that you just haven't been privy to for a while, and those with the training have quite a bit more. And there does seem to be a sense like of, because it's almost like a historical discipline in times, like where I don't know, it's hard to describe, but I got this sense that there's like a sense of no, like a particular canon that is expected to be known at different times. Yeah. Oh. And that's good. I mean, that's a potentially a good thing. And that means doing the patchwork can take a little time. And yeah, so I totally understand.
Cool. But in any case, and also when you're doing your PhD, basically you have to learn two things. One is academic philosophy, because of course, like one thing is to take a book, like a textbook in, I don't know, ethics, and read about what utilitarianism and this and that, or a textbook in philosophy of science and the, like realism and confirmation. Another thing is to learn how to be an academic philosopher, how you write, how to respond to objections, how to make a presentation, what makes an interesting contribution in philosophy, what's going to get you in the best journal. Right? That's also the other thing you have to learn at the same time. So it's a bit of a double challenge, but well, I guess in the end, in some way, I got over it. I managed.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell us perhaps a little bit about some of your like first works coming out of the PhD or finishing up. So what kinds of questions were you answering or attempting to address, and how are you going about doing it?
Okay. So my PhD thesis was also a bit of a compromise between my earlier interest in urban economics or regional economics and philosophy, because I decided the topic quite early on. And so, it turned out to be quite an interesting set of topics. So the target of my, my thesis is basically a collection of articles. And what these have in common is that they look at one particular episode in economics, which is the emergence of what is known as geographical economics. Mm-hmm. Geographical economics is basically was a new subfield. It was born around the 1990s, and it was a new subfield of economics that was really about incorporating, so to speak, the role of space into the effect of space on economic activity. Mm-hmm. The funny thing is, and the guy, so the main proponent of this geographical economics, which actually back then was called New Economic Geography, was Paul Krugman, who then got the Nobel Prize for this. So it was quite an important subfield. The funny thing is that its main aim is exactly that. Let's look at what spatial, what geography, what space affects, how it affects economic activity.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is that there was already urban economics that was also interested in that.
Yeah.
There was regional economics that was also doing that. There was economic geography, which is a branch of geography, which were also interested in doing that.
Yeah.
So basically, the emergence of this new subfield, or this new theory, if you want, I think it's more accurate to call it a subfield, raised a lot of controversy. Mm-hmm. So other scholars in urban and regional economics and in geography got pretty bothered by the fact. It was like, okay, now you're inventing, you're claiming to invent something to fill a gap in mm-hmm. economics, which is what space does to economic activity, but with it, you pretty much ignoring what we have done.
Other stuff, yeah. Years.
And that was interesting, how this controversy was playing out. That I found very interesting, and some of my papers were about that. And like, for instance, my first ever published paper was looking at the controversy between economists and geography and geographers. Uh-huh. About this, and it wasn't. It was published in a geography journal.
Yep.
And it received quite. It's one of it's a quite well cited papers. I mean, nothing extreme, but it's and it was quite well received. And so that was one interesting thing. The other thing that was interesting in this episode was also that, because of the controversy, the economists as well had to somehow be explicit about what their contribution was, right?
Sure.
What is it they were doing differently from the others? And that was really like a good way to find out what were the commitments of economy, like what they regard as valuable. So, for instance, one of the things they would say is like, okay, we can model. Geographers cannot model. They haven't been modeling these effects of space, these factors on how this space affects economic activity. We are able to give a unified account. We can explain clustering or agglomeration, why firms tend to cluster together at the city level, at the neighborhood level, and at the regional, at the international level. You guys haven't been able to do that. Mm-hmm. And so on and so forth. So because they had to justify, so to speak, their existence and their distinctiveness, so there was a lot of, it was quite a good case study to look at in order to learn about the commitments of economics, about what is a good explanation, what is a good model, what is a good way of understanding phenomena. Yeah.
Fantastic.
So that was pretty much my thesis, yeah.
Very nice. And so what was it like? I mean, so, you know, publishing in these other kinds of journals, like what motivated you to do that? And how did you feel? I guess what went into your decision and your experience there?
Well, that was quite smooth experience. In a way, it gave me the wrong impression that publishing was really easy. So my first paper, I got minor revisions and it was accepted, something like that.
Wonderful.
But what's the fuss about publishing so easy? But anyway, I guess it was relatively, perhaps it was easier back then than it would be now to write a paper that it's reaches out to scientists in a way that I think, right, because I was less of a specialist, so to speak, mm-hmm, was quite early on in my PhD, and I was less of a specialist. I think I was still able to, so to speak, to speak the language, the non-technical language, and to see what and how to simplify the point, mm-hmm, the philosophical point, in a way that would be of use to scientists. Mm-hmm. So basically, and also the philosophical point was relatively easy. It was like, look, you're asking different questions. There's no reason to, yeah, you're just asking different questions, and then actually much of the dispute has to do perhaps with other things about, like, the rhetoric, how it's being presented, but not in substance. In substance, it's really, you don't even need to choose because you are doing different things. But that, of course, I don't know. I mean, it's nice to publish for it was nice, and I think there was my supervisor, Oskar Limaki, who has always been quite keen on pushing his PhD students to be relevant to science.
Yeah,
and that's one way of being relevant to science, to reach out and to publish in scientific journal rather than only philosophy journal. So for that, I'm very grateful. Although, of course, for a PhD students, beginning PhD students, it might be a bit of a dangerous strategy as well because of what counts in. So I'm not sure that it counts like a publication in BJPS or a publication in News.
Right. Yeah. Definitely.
But it was. Yeah.
Very nice. All right. So, I guess, tell us a little bit about your next steps professionally. So studying at Erasmus, and then considerations of what you wanted to do, how you wanted to go forward. So what came next?
Yeah, I have to say that I don't think, while I was thinking, before talking to you, I was thinking, is there a way I can make, no, my I think I am one of these people, a bit impulsive, so my choices have become.
Doesn't have to be. We make choices how we make choices.
Yeah, exactly. So what happened is, like, so I finished my PhD and I got a fellowship in Rotterdam, like a 3 years doctoral fellowship. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, my supervisor, my PhD supervisor, moved from Rotterdam to Helsinki. Mm-hmm. And then he was like, oh, why don't you come for some time here? And I was like, yeah, it's fun. So he was putting together a group. Uh-huh. And I was like, oh, well. So I took 1 year off from Erasmus. I came here for a year. And I was supposed to stay here for a year and then go back to Erasmus. And then for some reason, I was like, okay, I take my chances. I stay here. Although I didn't have a position here. I was just a postdoc here as well.
Sure.
I took my chances here. I was like, okay, I stay here for a year. I apply for jobs. And then that's where the happenstance happened, where the random event happened, which is that I got a very prestigious fellowship from the Academy of Finland, which is a five years research fellowship, which is like, quite prestigious. It's well paid, and it's 5 years of research. So that, 5 years of full research with 5% teaching obligation.
Wow.
Yes, exactly. And then I was like, okay, then I stay. And then I stayed. And then, of course, in 5 years, you build a life in a place. And then and that's where I am. That's one thing I have to say. The other thing is that the group here is great. I think, and that's something I'm really happy to boast about, to brag about.
If you wouldn't mind boasting away, or just explaining, like, what makes the Center for Philosophy and Social Science in Helsinki, what makes this Finnish philosophy of science? Yeah, tell us a little bit about what's unique or particularly meaningful to you.
Yeah, so one of the things is that, of course, so. One of the things is that we share quite of some philosophical ideas, but I don't know if that's the main thing. I think it's like at some point we were about 20 people, all about postdoc or like early career researchers, let's call them, from all over the world, working in similar topics, reading each other's work. And then we've always been, encouraged to collaborate with one another, like joint papers. We had these seminars on Mondays and Thursdays where people would present work in progress. And if you like, I mean, even if it was sometimes it was really early draft, and someone else would go like, oh, that's interesting, let's do it together. And then it would start doing, and so many. So it was like, it's
that sounds
just
great.
So excited.
Yeah.
That be interested in going anywhere, right? I mean, I got most of my intellectual stimuli here.
Yeah.
And for my personality, I think that collaboration is particularly, I enjoy that. I mean, not everybody is the same, and some people might like more to work alone, but for sure, the way I am and the way I think,
yeah,
collaboration is really, even if it's either joint authorship, but also just turning my back to, one of my colleagues is sitting, one of my co-authors is sitting, and I'm like, okay, what do you think about this?
Totally, yeah.
Right, and then I'm like, maybe I start with an intuition, that's something that's just an intuition, it's just by talking with others that the intuition becomes an argument, and then from an argument it becomes a paper.
Yep.
It really, I mean, I guess it's a really thinking style, right, about, I mean, some people might just get everything in their head, whereas in my case, I get intuitions, I get a lot of them.
Right.
And then I need others.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to talk.
Yep.
And express them in order to see whether there is anything to them. So that I liked a lot. And also we had the luxury to be able to organize lots of conferences and events.
Mm.
So we really didn't have to go much elsewhere because we had here European Philosophy of Science Association.
Oh,
we had here the conference in logic, methodology, and philosophy of science. We had here the European Network of Philosophy of Science. I mean, we had loads of conferences. I mean, everything was going. Something was always going on, and it still is, although on a smaller scale.
Right. So I see you have a conference coming up that you guys are hosting, the INEM 2019 conference for the International Network of Economic Method. What's this going to be about?
There is an association that's called International Network for Economic Method, which is basically the association of philosophers of economics.
Okay.
Or anybody who's interested in philosophy of economics or methodology of economics. That's the idea that it's gathered under the INEM. And I'm the current president-elect. So.
Oh.
In 18 and 19.
Mm-hmm.
And the custom is that the president-elect in her last year of chairmanship, it's called chairman and not president, chairmanship, in the last year of chairmanship, she organizes the conference, or he organizes the conference at her own institution. And so it's not a thematic conference mostly. It's every 2 years, and it gathers all the interested parties. Everybody was interested. What the thing we've tried to do, I and the other members of the local organizing committee, was to try to involve a bit more the historians of economics and the sociologists of economics, and also feminist economics.
Okay.
So we've tried to join. Or at least the vision is to try to join a bit forces. So also our keynote speakers are not just the philosophers of economics, like the standard philosophers of economics, but for instance, we have a feminist economist, we have a historian of economics, and we have a sociologist of economics.
Wow.
So,
do you ever get a political economist?
Sorry.
This is a personal question. I have some folks. We have a pretty strong political science program here at my home university, and I'm familiar, have connections with self-described political economists, those who are in political science but who study and do research, social research, particular kinds of research, modeling research, actually, that looks into political economy. And I'm curious, are there folks from political science that are coming over?
Not so much, I have to admit. I think that some are, and I think that initially INEM was much more perhaps frequented by economists who were not like so much happy, or they were a bit with the standard ways of doing economics.
Yeah.
So I think that was... I might need to stand corrected by someone who is older and wiser than me, but my sense is also that philosophy of economics, like everything, has become more specialized.
Of course,
right?
Yeah.
And so now I think that most of the people attend. I think there are some economists or political economists or but I think the majority is us who study philosophy. Methodology of economics. And it's just because as the field is becomes much more specialized.
Okay.
I mean, like, philosophy of economics is quite of a recent field of the branch of philosophy of science. And actually, I don't know if you would even think of it as a branch of philosophy of science when it started.
Right.
I think it was mostly historians and critics of economics that were interested in methodology. But now, as you probably noticed, I mean, philosophy of economics has also become much more interesting for the philosophy of science community in general. So you get to publish also in the philosophy of science journals. And
I've spoken with a number of folks who do different kinds of model. Like, well, they really use a lot of modeling tools to apply to questions related to in economics. And as the number of the questions you asked before, it just seems to be that people are taking, it's not just philosophy of physics and philosophy of biology in this philosophy of science journal. So you're getting a lot of different kinds of the social and behavioral sciences out there.
Well, exactly. I think that one of the entry points for philosophy of economics has been the discussion of models.
Right.
I think that's how we got into...
you kind of harness from a more traditional topic in the philosophy of science, but it's like, models are a pretty big deal in economics it's like, then we have to talk about that. I mean, who knows what new science or what new, you know, specialty we might be exploring in 10, 20 years as well, given that we're going to see new trends or just new ways of thinking going on. So,
exactly. I think that nowadays my impression is that you could still publish something with a case study in economics, even if it's not on models. But I think that the models was the one that gave the philosophy of economics like the license, so to speak. Okay, now, because philosophy of social science, like the standard questions of philosophy of social science, I have the impression have been a bit more slowly getting attention in general philosophy of science.
Oh, great.
That's my impression. As I said, I haven't done a study of that. So, my impression is that you still have, I don't know, I think it's easier to publish in a top philosophy of science journal with something on models than with something on ethnographic methods.
Sure. Well, so if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about, so you've done, you told us a little bit about your professional, you know, career in achieving these positions. What about in terms of some of your work? What are maybe like one or two projects that you found the most perhaps influential in the field and or influential to you, you know, as a thinker, as someone interested in philosophy of science?
Yeah. So, well, So if I'm allowed, I would mention three things.
Oh, as many as you want.
So the one first thing is this paper, which actually is about models.
Okay.
So which is a co-authored paper with Jaakko Gorikoski and Aki Lehtinen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to ask you to repeat the names.
I'm just nodding along.
And it's called Economic Modeling as Robustness Analysis. And it's the paper that has received the most attention that I've so I think it's our best known paper. And well, it was fun to write. The case study was actually geographical economics,
mm-hmm.
But it could have been something else, but it was that. And it's a kind of a defense. You could say that it's a bit of a kind of rationalization of the modeling practice of economics. So one of the major criticisms economics always got from outsiders has been like, okay, so you just spend your time modeling and then you come up with new models that are different from the previous ones just because of one or two modeling assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like you're just playing a game by yourself. It seems like it's just doing it for your own sake. With very little, input from reality, from empirical evidence. What you do basically is really modeling driven. And then you guys come up with new models, and these new models are just small modifications of those that already exist.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is, can this practice be justified? I mean, in some sense, not, right? I mean, if it's empirical science, that cannot be fully justified. But then we thought, inspired by work by others like Wimsatt, I think there was Wimsatt, Levins, and Weisberg, we thought, oh, but what about if also economists, what they are doing is actually robustness analysis.
Mm-hmm.
What we can see, it just doesn't justify everything, but it justifies parts of it. Because what if you don't have ways of knowing how your unrealistic assumptions are affecting your results? Because you can't, in some cases, you simply cannot do without those assumptions. You know that they are not realistic. You know that they for tractability reasons, that they just needed to get the model working.
Yeah.
But you don't know, I mean, the point is that you have no way of checking how they are affecting the results. The only way to do that would be either to relax the assumption and replace it with a more realistic one. But in some cases, you can't, right?
Yeah.
So the next best is to say, okay, let's see. Let's basically keep much of the structure the same and vary the assumptions. They are all unrealistic, but let's see, how do they affect the result? Do I get the same results even if I'm changing the assumptions? Some of these assumptions. And if the answer is yes, then you are legitimated to have more confidence that the result is not an artifact of particular unrealistic assumptions. And so that was and then we gave an account of how this would work, right? Because
yeah.
I mean, you need to think about how these modifications happen, what kind of relation you have between these different models, and so on and so forth. But of course, it has been a controversial paper because it does seem to be quite a easy way out for economists, right? Okay, so they're doing robustness, so everything is fine, right? So it's perfectly legitimate for them to just forget about the world and do this robustness analysis. But of course, robustness analysis cannot, shouldn't replace empirical evidence, and also for other scholars, colleagues have been suspicious because of the fact that this is pretty, of course, it's not a full deductive argument. It's not a foolproof argument. So, I mean, there is always room for mistake unless you are able to change, to vary on every possible combination. You still have an element of doubt. You still have an inductive gap to fill. And so people have been pretty suspicious about that. But still, I think that I think it was a good paper, and I think it's it reflects a bit what I think, which is that I am quite of an optimist about science. So my point of departure is that scientists know what they are doing, and of course that doesn't mean that I never have prescriptive or normative comments to make or suggestions for revisions. But I think that the default assumption is that it's me who has to understand why scientists are doing what they are doing rather than me telling them what they should be doing.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? So in that sense, I'm not a skeptic. I'm really an optimist about science. And that's what the robustness paper also, at least in my view, embodies this. It's not a blanket justification to economics, but it's still like, okay, they are doing. Maybe it's not like, maybe they are doing something that makes some sense, and it's the challenge for the philosophers to understand how to make sense of it.
Yeah,
this is one. A related one is also something that it's quite related. It's on triangulation, which is also a paper I quite like. One might say that it's a follow-up to the robustness paper in the sense that it still, it also relies on this idea of that comes back to Levins, or Wimsatt, that you try to identify what is real from what is not by robustness, by trying to determine the results, the conclusion through different methods of determination. If they converge, then you have more confidence that the results, the conclusion, the theorem is correct. And in this case, we apply to experimental evidence and triangulation, methodological triangulation. So how scientists can get more confidence in the results by trying to determine it through different experimental setups.
Yeah.
Through different experiments. Mm-hmm. And the challenge there was to think about the scope of triangulation. This is also a joint paper with Jaco Gorykowski, and then we both had the intuition that there was something about triangulation. That there is something right about. Okay, different experiments, you get the same results, then you should have more. But there's also lots of critical literature about it.
So is this some kind of pluralism? Like, can we understand it as like an integrated or coordinated plural? Like, I'm looking at the different ways it's been described. I'm looking at the wiki right now. And it's really interesting that people, so for example, it's like, using more than one theory triangulation, you're using more than one theoretical scheme to interpret a phenomenon involving different kinds of data, involving multiple researchers. So I'm just interested in this concept that is particularly defined and applied within the social sciences.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think the problem with this, I think that much of the problem with robustness arguments or triangulation arguments or what have you is exactly this. But there is this intuition that's common across all these practices, which is you can see things like, let's make it as simple as possible. You can see things through different perspectives, or you can determine things through different modes, through different means.
Mm-hmm.
And these are independent of one another, right? They don't. And then if we all see the same, if all these methods converge on the result. I think we have more, the intuition is that we should have more faith that the result is real, right? Mm-hmm. If there is convergence between independent means of determination. And this is the common intuition. But then I think that one of the problems and one of the challenges and interesting feature of this is that, right, but in order for this to be a real substantive argument, you need to tell me, you need to have an account of what independence is in different cases. So mm-hmm. independence, for instance, of different people, for instance, think about the arguments for diversity in science, like cognitive diversity. And then you say, if we have cognitive diversity, we are more likely to, if there is cognitive diversity, we are more likely, it's more likely that if we converge, there is something there. But of course, independence between cognitive makeup, for instance, is totally different from independence between models, like what I was talking about before when I was describing the robustness argument. And independence of formal models or mathematical models might be a totally different thing from independence of experiments, right? But you need to specify what this independence is in order for a robustness argument or a triangulation argument to really work. Otherwise, it's just a optimistic promissory note, right?
Yeah.
Because the problem is that the convergence might just be the fact that all these different modes of determination are wrong in the same way.
Sure.
But what does it mean to be wrong in the same way or right in the same way? wrong in the same way or right in a different way? And that's what you have to specify. And that's what both these papers, and that's why I enjoyed them, because I find intuition quite compelling, but I think that without explaining how it works, and I think the explanation is different in different cases, then you without that, then it's just open to lots of it's not a very strong inference. That's what I'm saying. If you don't specify how it works, so for instance, you have to think about what kind of independence. And then in the case of triangulation, and we also distinguished between triangulating on phenomena and triangulating on theories.
You
can think about phenomena. What we say is like, okay, so what you get more confidence is the existence of the phenomenon. Which doesn't necessarily mean it's not necessarily the same kind of inference as when you think about a theory that gets diverse evidence as confirmation, right?
Right.
It might be a different kind of inference. And then our account only applies to phenomena. We don't say anything about theory confirmation. But that's also part of this aspect that I just told you, that I think that you cannot make these robust arguments applicable across the board. You really need to think about what is the methods that are involved, what is it that you are confirming, so to speak, and what kind of independence is required for this to work.
Right. How much, how connected has your work been in citing model questions with model robustness to in relation to the other modeling literature out there, perhaps in simulations and in things with like climate models and things like that?
Well, I guess much of that, ours was quite of an early, so the robustness paper, the economic models robustness analysis, was from 2010.
Okay. Oh, so, okay. So that's
So it was pretty early on. And I mean, there was Weisberg account already available. Right. And Weisberg, for instance, talks about, I think his example was the Lotka-Volterra model. Mm-hmm. But I think some of the climate change and robustness literature was afterwards.
Right. I think.
No, and then, yeah. Yeah.
The only one is one of our faculty, Elizabeth Lloyd, who wrote Model Robustness is a Confirmatory Virtue, and she's basically used the cases in climate science to try to talk a little bit, but I don't know if she's addressed, she might be addressing very dissimilar things. Maybe
no, I think it is. I don't think it is, but I think she, I mean, as far as I remember, I don't remember if I've read that, and I like her work, so, but my impression was that she didn't go very much into the details of how the robustness argument would work. So so I think it's, in that sense, it would be complementary, and in any case but I guess it's also it might be a bit different how you apply, for instance, to simulation models.
Yeah.
Because of the reasons I said. I haven't, I don't have a good answer at the moment, but it might be different because you might need to apply a different notion of independence, for example.
Yeah. Okay. And did you say you had a third project?
And the other paper that I'm very happy about, although it hasn't been picked up so much. Uh-huh. It's something that it's also models, and it's a comparative analysis of different of models of networks across different disciplines.
So
between it's mostly focusing on economics and comparing the economic variant of network theory to sociology and physics.
Yeah.
And the reason why that I enjoyed it was something that I got interested in because many years ago, when I was still doing my PhD, one of my flatmates was working on economics of networks. And it was quite one of the first, together with his supervisor, was one of the first people. He's called Sanjeev Goyal, and he's called Andrea Galeotti. He was one of the first people who did this economics of network. And then he was talking about this, and then I think I either borrowed from him or bought a book by this guy who's called Laszlo Barabasi, who's a physicist.
Yeah.
You know, he's quite famous. He also has a new book on like the success formula or something. Anyway, and he was like, okay, we found the theory of everything, you know? Phenomena as diverse as the spread of the stars, the topology of the cell, the structure of internet, the job search behavior, they are all network phenomena. And, you know, we have a theory for that. And the theory also, I mean, and then all these phenomena can be interpreted as graphs, and they all have features in common. So, for instance, things like power law distribution.
Mm.
Many of these networks have this feature in common. And they have this feature independently of whether the graph represents a cell, a network of people, or friends, or so on and so forth. So we got the unification, right? That was the example. Well, that would be a great example of unification. So you have one theory with which you can explain phenomena across different domains. Mm-hmm. And then it was quite exciting. And then I started to study it later on after I finished my PhD. I started to study it and I was like, right, but if you look at the model in economics, a model in physics, or a model in sociology of networks, they're so different.
Mm.
They're so totally different. So what is it that is really going on there? And then, so there are many aspects of this episode that I think are very interesting. And I still would like to write more about this. But in the paper that I did publish, what I focused on was to say, okay, so you see, there is this common modeling tool. Mm-hmm. Which is the one from network theory, which is an application of graph theory.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of modeling it. But then each of the disciplines, each of the fields,
yep.
When it imports it, it basically modifies it in such a way as to fit the what I call the field-specific methodological norms of that, the methodological norms specific to that field. So in particular, I was looking at economics because that's what the one I know more. I mean, it's not like I know much about the methodological norms of physics, but in economics, for instance, what they did was to combine that with game theory.
Right.
And again, as in the case of geographic economics back then, the one the first scientific episode I told you about, because it was a new field, they had to justify, and because there was so much other things going on, they had to justify their existence. So it was quite there was quite a lot of material that would make you that you could use to think about what is it that they think they are doing, how is their commitments about what is a good explanation, what is a good model, how are they affecting the way in which they take network theory and apply it to in economics. And so, for instance, you would see that it was the commitment to individualism, that you would well, that there was some kind of that was a commitment to general, to having general models rather than models of specific phenomena, and so on and so forth. And so this, so in that paper, my focus was on how economics differ from these other, from sociology and physics models of networks. But I think that more generally, what I learned from this episode is like how much, how significant are these methodological norms in determining differences across disciplines.
Right.
So like now, yeah. So that there is, even if, when you have shared modeling tools, or even when you have same concepts, or you are focusing on the same phenomena, these really play a, quite a big role in explaining the differences, the, how these, the differences between the fields.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Very cool. Very cool. this is, I mean, I think what, so what I hear and what I hear you describing is really some really great work by philosophies of science to come in and make sense of what is going on in the models and what is going on in the particular science, and provide some clarity and perhaps some retooling or rethinking of the arguments where the arguments are maybe strong, but where they're not working. And, so yeah, I think that's yeah. This sounds like some really great work. I noticed you have a forthcoming work in neuroeconomics.
Yeah, well, that's just an edited work.
Okay.
So it's basically it's major works. It's not much of a intellectual feat.
Gotcha.
So it's basically, it was quite, I mean, it was somehow time consuming, but it's basically putting together what are the major works written by others on neuroeconomics.
Cool.
So yeah, it's not much of a, it was a nice project to make. And I think they asked us, Jack and Roman and I, who are methodologists, philosophers. So unlike anything that a neuroeconomist would have done, you have one of the volumes is philosophy basically of neuroeconomics, which is quite unusual. Mm-hmm. But there isn't much of a substantive contribution from me there. Yeah.
Fair enough. Well, why not, since we're coming a little bit to the end, why don't I take this time to ask the question that I've been asking a number of guests, which is, what do you take to be the greatest challenge facing philosophy of science today?
Right. So, well, philosophy of science in general, I think that, as I mentioned before, I think that one of the challenges for philosophy of economics is to reach out to economists. Still, I think economists have been pretty reluctant to read our stuff. And I'm not saying it's also only economists' fault. It's also perhaps us becoming much more specialized,
right.
And I talk about myself too, so don't But I don't have very I don't know how to do that really. I don't have a very workout strategy. I have a sense, or like my sense is that maybe a stronger alliance with like neighboring fields like history of economics or sociology of economics might get us there. But that's one thing. And the other thing, I think, is maybe for philosophy of science more generally, the other challenge that I wanted to mention, that I might want to mention, is something about the sociology of the field, so to speak. I think I mentioned this to you in our introductory chat.
Yeah.
And it's the challenge of diversity. And then it's
right.
a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's this this idea of, I think we might want to get rid of the stereotype, typical stereotype about how a successful philosopher is. What is a successful philosopher? So so now I'm making a stereotype of the stereotype, if that's even possible. So like the successful philosopher is like brilliant, which is an attribute that you either have or you don't.
Right.
So it's not something
an
you
innate
learn.
Quality.
It's an innate quality. He is hard thinking, yep. reflective, thinks about philosophy all the time. So right, or most of the time.
Yep.
Publishes mostly single author papers.
Yep.
And then he has strong opinions about which is he is able to defend these opinions.
Yep.
Against any objection, and he has opinions about almost anything, right? Like anything in philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and then it's not very someone who's like, I'm not sure what to think about that. No, no.
Yeah.
He didn't know what to think about that. And I think this stereotype might contribute to curb diversity, both like diversity, like gender diversity, but also like diversity of approaches, like approaches, even cognitive approaches or something to
sure.
to philosophy. And it's partly my sense of this, my impression, but I think it is partly supported by some empirical studies. So, for instance, there is talking about the innate qualities of brilliance. There are studies, there is at least one study that has shown how philosophy is like mathematics, and other sciences, showing that in the sense that it's believed that you need to have an innate talent, right?
Right.
So something a special aptitude.
Sure.
And then the problem with this, I think, it's like that it ignores the truth. It ignores the reality. The reality is that you need to work hard. You need to have the right networks.
Yeah.
You need luck. And that's what success is about, right, as well. It's not just about
it's
the myth also of the self-made man, right, that it's just your own skills and capabilities that get you there,
right,
which I'm not sure I want to that I believe in,
right.
Or for example, this was a thing that other things about co-authorship, for example. Okay, this is gender diversity. And, of course, men also co-author. But, for example, I think that co-authorship is somehow still a bit... I mean, you can co-author, but you need also to show that you can do things by yourself, right?
Right, right, right.
And there have been studies, for instance, in economics that show that... co-authorship is more detrimental to women than to men, for example.
Oh, so it's been that's too bad. Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, but the general point is that I think these kind of stereotypes don't leave, and it's not. I don't want to just make a gender point. I think it's just like they make some people and some have to feel that they are. Scare away some kinds of personalities, the ones that are more insecure, the ones that are not always sure about whether they are the best or not,
sure.
And these kinds of things. And then, and of course there are exceptions, but I think they are too few to really provide an adequate suite of role models.
Yeah.
so that this becomes self-perpetuating and scares away some people who might just be great in their profession, but they're just a bit, they just are, don't fit this stereotype.
So how, yeah, so this is something perhaps for the social science researchers about addressing cultural stereotypes, and it's hard to, you know, it's something that can be biased. For example, like the incentives can perhaps have an effect on the interest in collaborating or in co-authoring. And I totally understand the reasons to not co-author, especially early on, because you do, in terms of demonstrating your own abilities. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it would be great if there was perhaps another way to demonstrate that. In the sciences, you know, you start your training in a lab, and you might, in undergrad, be a co-author, and then you're kind of, there's sort of like this shared authorship where, you know, you take your first author, you might run a study here, but everyone's working together all the time. Like, it's just never, you might do your own study, you might take up your own study, but you're typically collaborating in some way. It's never, it's always a division of labor. And so there's really never, I don't know. I mean, I'm just, it's still there. There's still an issue of like being first or last author, but.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, of course, I think we need, I mean, of course, we need proxies to decide. I don't know. We need, maybe we need proxies to decide who to hire, for example. But I think we have to, I think it might not be, I'm a bit skeptical that it's also so important, for example. Can there be people who are very good teachers and less good researchers? There might be people who are better co-authors than single authors.
Right, yeah.
And can we? Is it really the case that what is going to ensure the progress of the field, for example, is that we have great, only the best researchers who are able to write also by themselves. So right. You see what? So what I'm saying is that, in any case, first of all, they are proxies, and they are proxies to what? And so, what is it like? Quality, right? But quality isn't quality of the researcher, let's say, right? So the reason why you want to see whether someone is able to write by himself or herself is to see whether she can produce, I mean, or he can produce good quality work.
Right.
But they are actually, what we are aiming for is the good quality work. So that's
not the person who can do the work. Yeah, yeah. No, totally. Well, so I've taken, there's an analogy from like comedy writing. They do, what they have is a writer's room where they have, or like, let's say writing for television and film, they have a collection of writers that come in and write together, and they do work on projects together. They storyboard. But in order to get in that room, you still, it's a benefit that everyone has the capabilities mastered and down, like for themselves, not the sense that they could only do all their work. There's always the necessity to get into that room because it's that dynamic interplay with which the best work comes out of. However, there is some sense of like not using others as a crutch to, you know, go to, so it's like, it works better, the dynamic, a dyad or yeah, you know, two or three people, when everyone has the abilities not to do everything on their own, but at least has the skills and the tools that could best contribute to that two or three or four person team that creates the work. So how to demonstrate that? You're right. I don't think it's you're right. Showing like we're after the good work. That's what I've always thought. I'm like, why can't we, if we really want good work, why are we just valuing the person who does the good work? Like, you know, or that's, yeah, it's tricky to kind of figure out.
But also because how do you value the person who does the good work is through proxies, because anyway, you don't, I mean, it's,
right.
So that's a bit of a, I think, but the it's not just co-authorship, or it's not about that. The point is like, we have to be aware of the fact that we scare away. So some kinds of people who, in the moment that they don't fit, for instance, one of the, I felt that, I mean, like, I never felt like that was, if I got an objection, I usually am pretty good at thinking, of a counter argument, but it's not like I'm never 100% sure at what I'm saying. I mean,
right.
Even if I thought hard, okay, maybe I'm sure, but it's not like something that I always listen and put into question whether what I'm saying is might or might be, not be wrong. And then when I was faced with these people who are always so sure, were always, I'm almost, I mean, it's just like, okay, yeah, so sure that they are in the right and yeah. that their views, it did give me the feeling maybe I don't have what it takes, right?
Right.
And that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm worried about, that because of the, or like if you have to become very aggressive in seminar, if you have to have a bit of this aggressive, arrogant attitude in seminars in order to, when you ask questions or also when you respond to questions, which you find sometimes in philosophy seminars, and you don't have that. You don't have that personality.
Right.
So I think there is a paper by Helen Beebe that discusses the adversarial nature of debate in philosophy. If you don't have that, I mean, what do you think? You think, well, maybe that's not for me.
Yeah.
I do something else. But then you perpetuate the stereotype. So that's my worry. It's not like the particular, it's not necessarily what it is, the stereotype about is that there is such, and that it scares away, that it selects for certain personality and scares away other personalities, and then becomes self-perpetuating. But those characteristics don't necessarily have to do with, enable the progress of the field.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's in a nutshell.
Perfect. Well, Katarina, thank you for sharing. I completely share and with you in your concerns, and I'm hopeful that. Well, I mean, it's sort of like interviews like this that sort of really speak to and expose and are transparent in regard to like the actual people who are doing philosophy of science are not like this stereotype. And, you know, like just to realize that there are other people out there that like you, if you like the ideas and you like doing this kind of thinking, this kind of work that is, I think, really, really important, you can find other people like you with certain thinking styles. Yeah, sure. There's going to be the person that's maybe, you know, the more akin to that stereotype of, you know, does their own work. And, you know, we probably all know writers who really much prefer to write alone, you know, journalists, reporters, things where it's like, okay, cool. But like, we don't need to like honor that and create that archetype and pay lips, you know, try to recreate it and try to establish it in our future scholars. Like, you know, I mean, I've been in around, you know, in graduate programs where like even the graduate students are like ranking others in terms of who's better, you know. I was like, and like literally competing of like, well, this person I think is the best in the program, and this, and it's like, what? Like, you go into a science department, that just doesn't happen. Like, you might be talking about who has the most publications, but no one is like ranking based on like their skill. Like, it's just such a weird, coming from the sciences, it was just such a weird switch to understand this kind of thing. But so hopefully, you know, with more time, there will be some change in the culture.
I think they already are. They already are. I think they're getting there. Yeah.
I mean, we're seeing groups like this. I mean, the fact that there is such a thing as the, you know, philosophy of social science group, like they're starting to understand these like collections of group, you know, more collaborative, and just like just the way in which stuff is getting done is different now. It seems to be different. So that's really cool. All right, well, Katarina, thank you so much for taking the time. Is there anything?
Thank you.
Yeah, anything else you want to mention we didn't get to, before we go?
Well, we didn't talk about my future research, but it's entirely my fault. No, we shouldn't.
Okay.
It's entirely my fault because I thought I would be very succinct and that this interview would last very shortly. And apparently,
I appreciate you hanging in.
apparently, I was long. It was much more talkative than I expected. But anyway, so there is future work. I'm still working.
Sure.
Although I'm going to go on maternity leave soon, right?
Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And my best of luck, and I hope that goes well, and I hope you have a wonderful summer. And
you too.
Yeah, yeah. I hopefully will make my way to Finland at some point, or if you're Hope to see you at a conference.
You should. thank you for the interview, for the chat.
Yeah, actually, absolutely.
For the chat, it was quite fun, and the time really went fast.
I really enjoyed it as well. Thanks for hanging out for longer than you expected.
Thanks, Nick. Bye.
Right. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.